They'd been left in limbo there, and in the sense that their employees were given a pay raise, but yet the governor cut the general fund allocation, not the off budget. And so they felt that they were dealt a double whammy, and not only having the general funds cut, but also forced to pay the increase.
The budget was built literally by taking all the things that were additive to the current fiscal year, things like student enrollment, and I don't think that there was actually an increase required there, but you looked at all the drivers of the budget, added all those drivers in. The 1.5% was a driver. So you added the 1.5% into the budget, and then you began to take all the things away, the debt retirement, the $14 million there net for debt retirement. Then you reduced the budget, and in various departments, we were all hit with different kinds of reductions. I think the university was only asked to take a 1.5 or a 1.2 or whatever it was, a percentage reduction. It was after everything was loaded in. So they got the benefit of the elevator going up, and yes, they took a reduction. But they're not being treated any differently than any other department of state government in that respect. We all wrote it up, and we are all writing it down, and we're all dealing with it.
Well, I'm personally glad that you're using all aspects of the budget nowadays instead of general funds. Another subject, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Briefly, we need to get up. We got two more departments, so we'll try and wrap up.
Early retirement incentive. You mentioned private enterprise does this and so on and so forth. And I love the way private enterprise does it. But when they get a early incentive program, they cut that position out, period. In our situation, it seems like I still maintain we didn't save at all in the last two early retirement because we owe an additional $295 million in arrearment to the retirement funds. In early retirement for private enterprise, they have certain principles that they live on and live with. When you cut government and cut it back, private enterprise, that's it. You work with less staff. But government doesn't do that. Government said, well, we're going to hire new people at less pay, and then 3 or 4 years, they're at the same pay, so we have to pay them. I have a question. If we're constantly increasing the salaries of teachers, increasing the salaries of employees, and then we say you're getting paid too much, we're going to pay you to quit because you're getting paid too much. Something's wrong there, and then we're going to fill that position up with people with less pay. So in your pursuit of the new retirement incentive, are you going to use the two principles that private enterprise does?
Some of them, Mr. Chairman, is the answer. The separation incentive piece is designed to only come into play when you are eliminating a job. And the perfect example, again, is what we're doing at Harborview. With the 80-plus employees that are left there, some, let's just say a third of them, will vent out through a retirement incentive plan. Those people disappear, those jobs disappear, those PCNs disappear. Probably for the first time in a purist sense that's occurred. Same thing with the separation incentive. You've got some people that aren't old enough, don't have the years of service to be able to vent out at the top of the system, but we want to be fair to them, give them a new start, perhaps some money for training or additional education. But those PCNs disappear. When Harborview closes, it closes. Those positions disappear. It doesn't mean that there aren't new positions that are created by fiscal notes or some other priority of state government. They don't pop up, though. And I think that's one of the elements you're trying to get at. And it's very difficult because the balloon does squeeze out in other areas that are represented by priorities of government and by the legislature.
It's my understanding you have 700 employees right now ready for early retirement. They've been waiting for 2 or 3 years, so that number's probably increased. And I hope you use that same principle besides just Harborview. Thank you.
Representative Terrio, real brief.
Yeah. When it comes to public radio, public TV, not all the providers in the state kind of opted into that plan. Does the administration have a position on that?
Tough question, Mr. Chairman. The public radio, there was only one station that was vying for funding that didn't receive funding. And the public radio grants are out in the field now, I think. I'm fairly sure that we have an RFP on the street with regard to radio. On the TV side, we, as you know, went to a unified signal. The legislature directed us to go to a unified signal. The station that was capable and had the equipment the assistance of a federal grant with that was KUAC in Fairbanks. So Alaska One, that you all see, broadcast and formatted out of KUAC in Fairbanks, is that single service. And Anchorage, KAKM, chose not to participate with us in that venture. Last year, when the question was before the legislature on who could produce the unified signal, KUAC came forward and said they would do it for a very little adjustment to their operating budget. KAKM came forward with a $1 million or a $1.2 million capital budget appropriation, said, if you give it to us, we'll do the signal. Well, that was a no-brainer for us. We went with KUAC, they had the equipment. They're up on the air as of sometime in early October. We are proud of it. We're proud of that redesigned, re-engineered service to Alaskans, and we hope that you're happy with it too. But Anchorage's KAKM is still outside of that unified signal. They are not broadcasting that signal. And the administration has full funding for the TV stations, all four TV stations, in its budget this year, and that's the position of the administration, is that all four should be funded at this time.
And Mr. Chairman, just a quick comment. I appreciate your comments at the beginning saying that some of the tough decisions we made last year ended up being the right things to do. We should flag that section of the tape, and 3 months from now when we're getting beat up, perhaps we should play it back, because sometimes making those tough decisions do turn out to be the right thing to do.
Someone said unity is a two-edged sword. I think that was a legislator after the governor's speech a week and a half ago. And believe me, we think it's important that we're all together in charting out the future of the state of Alaska. Unity is very important.
Representative Corrin?
I have numerous questions, and it would probably take 30 minutes. However, I'll save them for my budget subcommittee hearings. And I just basically wanted to say I really enjoyed working with Mark and his staff. I found it very professional. We did have a budget hearing back in October to start the dialogue and information gathering process and to hear what the input from the public was. I appreciate your participation in that. And we have our hearings scheduled now, so we're going to get going with this process in short order.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Two-time commissioner before us this year, so I feel like we've already talked to you.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Will Condon, the Commissioner of Revenue, here to give you a brief overview of the Department of Revenue budget. I have most of my division directors and the two revenue deputy commissioners with me here today. Deborah Vogt, Deputy Commissioner for Operations and Taxation, and Ross Kinney, Deputy Commissioner for Treasury. I won't take your time introducing the rest right now. If you turn to page 7 in the budget overview book that we made available to you, I will begin by just saying a few things about the numbers. What you see reflected there on page 7 is the general fund budget for the Department of Revenue. There are numerous aspects of the department which are funded by funding sources other than the general fund, but let's just focus on the general fund here for a moment. As you can see, we have proposed reductions in three divisions, increases in two, and I think the main point that I want to make here is that in proposing reductions for the three divisions, which really are at the heart of what you think of as revenue, which is our two taxation divisions and our treasury division, we've tried to be careful not to propose reductions that in turn will reduce state revenue over the next couple of years. In the years to come, we are certainly going to come back to you and propose further reductions in our two tax divisions. This will come about as a consequence of getting caught up on audits and getting new regulations in place, which will make the state of Alaska's tax programs clearer and the need for audits somewhat reduced. Let's turn for a moment to the income and excise tax division, which is covered in pages 14 to 17 in the booklet that we passed out, and the points I want to make there are the following. With respect to the income and excise tax division, over the last couple of years, they have changed their approach to auditing major taxpayers. They've gone from assigning a single auditor to a single taxpayer to a team approach. As a consequence of that change, the average time to complete an audit of a major taxpayer has decreased from 4 years to 18 months. We're still behind in terms of where we think we ought to be with respect to auditing major taxpayers in the corporate income tax area, which is the responsibility of the Income and Excise Audit Division. We believe that we will be completely caught up in terms of having audits bumping right up against the current time in 2 more years. The other point I'd like to make with respect to the Income and Excise Audit Division is that they have been going through a transition to a new computer system. That new computer system was implemented in the autumn. I think it's been successful, and as a consequence of that, we believe that we're going to have a much more efficient income and excise operation. Moving to the Oil and Gas Audit Division, which is covered in pages 18 to 21 of our overview book, here I think are the salient points. 4 years ago, the average period under audit was 6.5 years old. In other words, the average time period for taxpayers who reported and paid their taxes to the Oil and Gas Audit Division were being audited for periods 6.5 years before the then current time. Today, the average period under audit is 2.5 years old. And obviously the math is going to tell you that we've done 8 years worth of auditing in the last 4 years. Similarly, 4 years ago, the average oil and gas taxpayer faced 12.5 years of unresolved taxes. In 1991, the average taxpayer had all of their taxes from 1979 through 1991 unresolved. Today, the average taxpayer has 4.5 years unresolved. We've resolved 12 years worth of taxes for the average taxpayer over the last 4 years. We still have a couple of major old matters which we need to resolve, and we're going to need another year to year and a half and to catch up. We will catch up so that we're current in the Oil and Gas Audit Division just a bit sooner that we will in the Income and Excise Division. With respect to both divisions, we have ongoing regulation adoption efforts underway. Our objective in the oil and gas area is to make it possible for the taxpayer to know in advance whether they are paying the correct tax. This requires completing the change in the basic tax regulation scheme that we put in place to implement the legislature's tax legislation. Again, it's not going to be a year before we have that effort completed in the oil and gas audit area. With respect to the corporate income tax area, it's going to take us more than a year to complete our regulation reform effort. With respect to the Treasury budget, and the description is covered in pages 22 to 25 of the overview book, just one point that I want to make, and that is that while we have a $93,000 reduction proposed in our general fund funding for the Treasury Division, that is not a $93,000 reduction overall in the budget. The budget is just reduced $63,000 and $29,900 of the general fund reduction is shifted to other funding sources. And I just want to make sure that you don't think I'm trying to pull a fast one on you there. That is, in fact, what we're proposing to do, and we want to be explicit in bringing that to your attention. Child Support Enforcement Division is covered in pages 26 to 31 of our overview book. And there is one aspect, there are several aspects of the Child Support Enforcement budget that I'd just like to touch on while we're talking about it from the broad overview perspective. In the budget book, there is a color graphic between pages 28 and 29, and it looks like this. And I want to just walk through that graphic, if I might. The point that this graphic I intended to make with this is that the Child Support Enforcement Division, while you must appropriate a piece of general fund money to fund the division, in fact, the general fund actually ends up a little bit ahead as a consequence of this program in terms of the direct activity of the program and the way the program is funded. The basic program is funded on the basis of a general fund funding with a federal match. In addition, and you can see that up there at the top, the basic federal funding for FY95 was $1.6 million, and the federal match was $8.3 million. The state is also permitted, if it has a successful program, to get additional federal funds called federal incentive funds as a consequence of doing a good job in accordance with the established standards in the federal regulations in collecting back AFDC payments to welfare recipients. And under the new federal welfare program, whatever name, family assistance program, whatever name they give it, that will be true under the new federal program as well, if one is in fact passed. And as the state collects back AFDC payments, it is permitted to take a portion of the federal share that is collected back and use it to fund the program. And in fact, if you look at each year over the last few years at the Child Support Enforcement Program, you'll observe that that is a funding source which the legislature has specifically used in budgeting for the program. In FY95, you budgeted $2,497.3 million, and it was spent. In addition, the state got was able to take another $216,000 in the incentive payment out of the collections back of AFDC, and that money went directly into the general fund. That covers the blue box on the graphic. In addition, the state is permitted and to send a bill to the federal government for the indirect costs of the program, and it does so. There are two different billings that go to the federal government, one from the Department of Revenue as a consequence of its claim for indirect expenses, and the Department of Administration makes a claim as well. Together, the state made a claim and was paid in FY95 for $1,547.8 million. You used that payment to the state as a funding source for part of the commissioner's office and part of the administrative services division, and you've done that now, I believe, this for 3 years. But if you add up the general fund money that you're appropriating to run the child support enforcement program, $1.6 million, and then you add up the payments that came back from the federal government as a consequence of having the program, you'll find that there were payments back which slightly exceeded the $1.6 million that you appropriated, and that does not count the recapture of AFDC benefits in the blue box other than the direct incentive payment. It's a long-winded way of saying that the program, in fact, is from a direct operations perspective, fully funded by the federal government, even though you must appropriate general fund money to make it work. Probably a couple of things I ought to say generally about the operation of the Child Support Enforcement Program. The program has the responsibility for slightly more than 40,000 cases. Of those, just a little over 20,000 cases are basic in-state cases, Alaskan families, Alaskan custodial parents, Alaskan obligors, and the job is Alaskan to Alaskan in terms of getting the support payments. And about 19,000 of the cases involve a situation where parents, some are here and some are in other states. We have about 5,500 cases where the custodial parent and the children are in another state, and the absent parent, obligated parent, is here in Alaska. And then we have almost 14,000 cases where the children and custodial parent are here in Alaska, and the non-custodial parents are in other states. If you look at our statistics, we do, and I can't at this moment tell you whether from every perspective it is a good job, but it is certainly a consistent job. Month in and month out, we collect 45% of the cases where it's Alaskan to Alaskan, or where it is people where the children are outside and they've come to Alaska and asked Alaska to collect the money for them. When you look at the 14,000 cases where you've got kids and custodial parent here in Alaska and the obligor in another state, we're dependent on other states to finish carrying the ball on those cases, and we don't do so well on those cases. Our rate of collection, or the rate of collection in those cases, because I shouldn't use our, because it does require the partnership of our sister states, but the collection there is in the 18-19% area. It's well under half the success rate that we enjoy with 18% area. It's well under half the success rate that we enjoy with respect to cases which we're fully responsible for, or cases where we're trying to help another state. And I wanted to bring that to your attention in the overview. I'm sure we'll discuss it in detail in the specific review of our budget in the subcommittee. But again, points there. We certainly do a lot better job for other states than they do for us, number one. Number two, we are consistent in terms of what we do for our own people and what we do for other states. And third, the surprising imbalance where there are almost three times as many cases where you have children and custodial parent in Alaska and are going to another state to try to collect money, as opposed to children and custodial parents in another state and they're coming to Alaska to try to collect. Anyway, I think that's probably enough on child support enforcement. Permanent fund dividend division, covered in pages 32 to 35 of the overview book. As you know, that operation is funded by the permanent fund dividend appropriation. There are two aspects of that program which I think I should bring to your attention. One is the increase in appeals that has taken place with respect to the permanent fund dividend program over the last few years. And if you look in the commissioner's office section on page 43, there's a table there which reflects the increases that have occurred in appeals. And as you can see, we've grown a number of appeals from 639 in 1992 to 1,060 in 1995. These are calendar year statistics. While we're there, you can see that in the child support enforcement area, the number of administrative appeals that we're having to handle has increased rather remarkably there as well. And the other thing with respect to the permanent fund dividend division that I wanted to mention is the regulation review that is currently underway. Our director, Nancy Jones, has asked people who are working with the program, legislative staff, legislators, the ombudsman, interested citizens, to go through the regulations with her to see whether there are not changes that we can make which will make the program more user-friendly but nevertheless preserve the basic integrity of the program. And that is underway. And if any of you have suggestions, we'd sure welcome them. And I'm sure that some of you will. The charitable gaming division, for which I'm responsible, appears on descriptively in pages 36 and 37 of our overview. And I don't want to say too much about that. Obviously, we're protecting three interests there. We want to make sure that charities get their fair share, that the state gets the taxes and fees that it's owed, and that the games are conducted fairly. The audit staff is mostly aimed at making sure the charities get their fair share and that the state gets its taxes and fees. The investigative staff, which is currently three and which we propose to reduce to two in this budget, focuses a fair amount of its attention on the fair conduct of the games and also making sure that the folks who are running the games don't simply rip off the charities affected dishonestly. Want to say something about admin services because we are asking for an increase there. One of the things that is necessary, we believe, to make our department work more efficiently and make it possible to reduce personnel and expenditures in future years is to make better use of the technology that's available across our whole department. We need to be able to do that through our administrative services division. And we are asking for another support person in our information services data processing effort aimed at achieving longer term efficiencies in terms of what we're doing and where we're going. I don't really have anything specific to say about the commissioner's office other than that once again to direct your attention to the current appeals situation. The governor is proposing a bill which would remove the tax appeals function from the Department of Revenue and place it administratively in another department so that the situation for a couple of important reasons. One, taxpayers perceive the situation and the system as being unfair, where the commissioner is seen as both advocate and judge with respect to tax matters. To try to deal with that in the past, the commissioner has constructed a Chinese wall between himself or herself and the ongoing day-to-day administration of the major tax programs of the state. I don't think that's the way we ought to run things. I think the commissioner should be trying to set policy and control the direction of the tax divisions, and that the appeals opportunity that we necessarily must be provide should be divorced from the commissioner's office. We propose to retain the appeals responsibilities that go with the permanent fund dividend division and the child support enforcement division, but we're going to have to take a long look at these given the numbers that we see in terms of trying to figure out why the numbers are growing and if there isn't some way that we can move this process along and make it work better. We have a whole host of boards and commissions and corporations and authorities which are attached to our department. I don't propose to include any of their budgets today other than to mention the ABC board, which is continuing on at the same budget level as it has in earlier years. The possibility that the changes that have been proposed in the governor's executive order with respect to the Post-Secondary Education Commission and the Student Loan Corporation, those responsibilities would come to the Department of Revenue, and Diane Behrens is here to speak briefly about the post-secondary education budget, and I can let her go ahead, or I can answer questions and then let her step forward, whichever is the chair's wish.
Okay. Representative Terry Martin.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner, you know, last year we did a real good detail with your people really cooperating on all the divisions you have, about 14 of them under your department. And it was my feeling, and I hope to talk to some of the other members, that we don't need all that detail again to save you a lot of time, but I'm going to make some of our meetings more of a work session and policy development with you, and especially when we come to the Child Enforcement Agency, because I really think we need to get a better handle on that. We feel like we're putting more and more millions into it. Federal money's coming in, other money's coming in, and here you gave us the number of 40-some thousand. Last year, I think it was saying 36,000. So this number keeps on growing, and I don't know why, except that in talking to some of the people there, that they really feel that they're not being backed up, and you heard me talk to the Department of Law, that's where the real hang-up is, and I think we need to be open, hopefully, in later meetings. Is there favoritism going on? Is there scarcity tactics going on? Are we afraid of who in legislature or even in the court, who owes, who's in the rear? Whatever the problem is, let's get over it, and perhaps can we pursue civil litigation more, which is my understanding, if they only got that break, that many other people would be coming running in the door and be more than glad to pay. But it seems like the Department of Law, and of course you were there too, is hesitant to help. I hope we can get over that. Also, the Permanent Fund Corporation, it was interesting, it brought to my attention at least three or four times by individuals saying, well, look, if Permanent Fund is doing this, look what SBS is doing, look what TOE's doing, look what PO's doing. And so we had a very capable person that I just hired who's very good in financing. That's her whole education. I said, look at this as a peripheral, and let's challenge the different agencies within your department. Why is SBS doing so good? Why is Permanent Fund? Of course, she's come up with some interesting things, but I think we should have that kind of an open challenge, and I hope by February the 7th, that'll be our first meeting, to let the public know what's at stake, why Permanent Fund perhaps has her hands tied if they do it all, why SBS is making good this year, but in a five-year overview, it doesn't look that good. And it's those kind of things I'm going to get involved in more to give us as legislative security and also the public security that your department is handling the money well.
I'll just respond briefly, if I might, Mr. Chairman. That is, we're anxious, Representative Martin, to discuss the child support enforcement program with you. There are a number of policy options which you're necessarily going to want to look at. The size of the staff there has grown significantly in the last couple of years. Almost everybody in the agency has moved into a new job. Nevertheless, even with the upset that goes with reorganization and the changes that have come with size increases, I think that the staff has done a remarkable job when you look at the statistics, and we look forward to reviewing that with you. And on the investment front, we're getting ready for the February 7th meeting.
Yeah. And we also understand you made some good changes from my commoner's point of view in marketing out some extra money to $800 million and getting private enterprise to bid for those contracts and so on. And I guess you received the same letter I did last week about why don't we invest more into Alaska. And I guess we're going to have to answer that challenge time and time again. Is Alaska a good market to invest in? So I hope we can get more of those kind of questions solved for the public that are lingering rather than just look at your budget. The other one, Executive Order 97 for the post-secondary, I felt right now would rather leave that up to the, I think you have that Health and Education Social Service Committee, and I felt we'd just wait to see what they do with the executive order.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I'm confused. Does that mean you do not want Ms. Behrens to review
the
budget?
Well, she can, but I know that they have major concerns about it. I was originally when it came here the other day. We saw for the first time with DOE. I noticed a transfer of $9 million to Department of Revenue, but I didn't see that in revenues right away. We didn't pick it up. So I asked, and we've had that trouble before in executive orders where they decreased the money in one agency but didn't put it in the other where they're putting the work at. And then what part? I didn't want you to get straddled with the toy baby that they can't handle. You got enough problems now, and especially if they didn't transfer the money.
Did you have a
question, Representative Mulder.
Real quick, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thanks again, Commissioner, for coming before us. I noticed from your charts that the number of appeals within the Permanent Fund Dividend program has increased dramatically over the last few years, and my suspicion is one of those reasons pertains to the so-called piggyback provision, a piece of legislation that we all voted on in the House here, I know, and is in the other body, passed our body quite decisively, would have taken care of that program or problem. Commissioner, are you working with the senator from Eagle River who has a concern about opening the so-called floodgates in relation to that program and or provision in trying to resolve that problem? Because I do think it is a discriminatory policy, and I really would like to see the problem resolved.
Mm-hmm. Representative Mulder, we have spoken on several occasions with the senator from Eagle River, and we will continue to do so.
Do you foresee any, I mean, can you see any light at the end of the tunnel? Is there any common ground yet?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, I don't know what the committee, the Senate Finance Committee, intends to do with this matter. We've spoken with them, told them that we support this. As you know, this affects the families of our congressional delegation, and they've certainly written me on several occasions about it, and as a consequence of that, I've journeyed over to the fourth floor here, to speak with Senator Halford, but I don't know what the Senate Finance Committee intends to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Commissioner Rue, we're running short of time, and I will give you the offer to join us, or we can put you off till Wednesday, whichever you choose. It's probably about 15 minutes.
I can make a very short presentation.
Okay.
Frank Rue, Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game. With me today, I've got Kevin Brooks, the Director of Admin, my Administration Director, and then behind me, Rob Bosworth, the Deputy Commissioner. In case you have questions, I can't answer. I believe Frank Holman is also here from the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, in case you have questions in that area. What I'd like to do is give you a very brief overview today of the department's budget, and I've handed out a couple of charts. I'll have more detail as we get into the subcommittee hearings, but this is just to give you the broad outlines of where we are. Quickly, I'd like to just review the importance of fish and wildlife to people. We sometimes forget when we look at numbers that people are behind these numbers. It's important for jobs, for food, for recreation. It's an integral part of the culture of Alaska. A couple of quick statistics. There are 400,000 sport fish licenses sold each year, over 30,000 commercial use licenses. It's the second, fish and wildlife, the second in direct revenue to the state behind oil and gas. It's the number one employer in the state. Tourists look at fish and wildlife as one of the primary reasons they come to Alaska. And subsistence, as you all know, is critical to many Alaskans. So for many people, fish and wildlife is critical. I also wanted to just mention a few of the hot issues that we're dealing with. We are sort of daily dealing with issues protecting Alaska's fish and wildlife in various federal arenas. This includes the Endangered Species Act reauthorization in Congress, the Magnuson Act reauthorization, North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, Pacific Salmon Treaty. We are working on implementing the subsistence law in a fair and equitable way. We are trying to ensure fair treatment in front of the Federal Subsistence Board as that entity moves forward. We're participating in international treaties on the Yukon, as well as the Pacific Salmon Treaty. We're dealing daily in complex allocation issues, such as the Cook Inlet fisheries dispute that's going on now, the Area M dispute. We're looking at ways to mediate some of those allocation disputes. We're working on developing a subsistence solution. And we're implementing the Migratory Bird Treaty Act that was recently signed, working on implementing that. So there's just a tremendous number of hot issues, as well as, say, marketing Alaska's fish that right now is becoming a headline topic. Many of these hot issues that go along with the job that we are doing today of managing what I believe is the best fish and wildlife department in the country, despite what Mr. Tobin of Canada might want you to believe. We produced over 200 million salmon in abundance, and everything from producing that many salmon to managing a moose hunt in Anchorage, sort of an incredible array of issues that we face. Very quickly, there are four principles that underlie our budget. First one, and without these four, we really won't be successful in managing the state's fish and wildlife resources. First one is we've got to have good management in season, on the ground, management of our resources. And if you turn to the first page in this brief handout, you'll see the number of offices we have around the state. Some of these might be one-person seasonal offices, but nonetheless, we feel that it's important for our management to be on the ground, out in the region, rather than centralized. The second key part of our whole program is good information. We need good science-based information to determine health of stocks so that we know what's available for harvest. Third, we need to protect habitat. Without healthy habitat, management programs will not be successful. If the resource doesn't have a way to propagate and supply people with a resource, it just won't work. And finally, we need a good public process. Public process includes the boards of fish and game, but it also includes over-the-counter information at these offices to the Alaskan public. It includes daily contact with people, telling them what's going on, where they can find resources. If you look at our statutes, they reflect these four principles as well. And so we feel we're implementing our statutory mandate by managing according to these four principles. The other thing, just very quickly, we're now organized into six divisions, each of which has a certain expertise and responsibility. It's critical for us to make sure that we've got good coordination and cooperation among these divisions, which we try to do. Sometimes we think of each division being of an isolated entity. Well, they're not. If you think of a salmon, for instance, going up the Yukon River, we have to deal with that fish on the federal arena through the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. We then have the Comfish Division dealing with that fish out in the commercial fisheries from the Shumagins all the way through to the Yukon. You have a subsistence division that needs to gather information on how subsistence users are using that resource, and there's a sport fish harvest on that resource. So that one resource moves through a tremendous number of fisheries and through a tremendous variety of publics, and we need to have a good coordinated department program that deals with all those ways that resource can be used. Figure 2 gives you a short history. First of all, I guess just the thing that was in the OMB book shows that we're about 2% of the total operating budget. And if you flip to the next, it's actually figure 3. The bar chart gives you a recent history of the division department. It shows that our general funds and program receipts have been reduced since 92. Basically, if you look between 92 and 96, I think it's about a 25% reduction. Our other funds have been growing. Our total budget is around $95 million. I think what's important is to also note, as I did earlier, that we went from 9 to 6 divisions as we reduced that general fund component. If you look at the next figure, you'll see that in our FY97 request, we've got a bunch of different funding sources. You've got fish and game funds, which is about 21%. These are restricted funds. You've got federal funds accounting for about 32% of our budget. General fund program receipts are about 8% of our budget. General funds are about 35%, and other funds are about 4%. So as you can see, general funds are starting to make up well less than half our budget. And many of the federal and fish and game funds are fairly restricted in how we can use them. And that's an important sort of part of our budget. The next figure, if you flip to that, figure five, shows our total budget request and how it splits out among the division. If you look at all our funding sources, this shows how it is parceled out among the different divisions. So just quickly, you'll see wildlife conservation is about 19%. Sport fish is about 19%. Com fish is about 42% of our budget. Not surprising. The Limited Entry Commission is 3%, admin 5%, subsistence 3%, boards 2%, and on down the line. Obviously, the large part of our budget are the major management divisions, wildlife, sport fish, and com fish division. If we look, one of the important, if you look at the next chart, final one, that shows how our general funds and general fund program receipts are spread out among the divisions. And you can see 74% of our general fund and general fund program receipts are in the commercial fish division, 6% in limited entry, habitats about 6%, subsistence 3%, boards 4%, admin 3%, commissioner's office 2%, sport fish and wildlife each get a very small amount, partly because employees pay rent for housing and they need to do it into the general fund. But those two divisions have basically zero general funds in them. However, they have seen increased revenues the last couple of years. That's the general overview of how our funds are spread out among the divisions and the source of dollars. To understand where we are this year, I want to give you quickly address what happened to us last year, because it does set the stage for this year. As you know, our general fund was reduced $1.8 million last year, a little over 5%. As I said last year, there were certain high-priority, statutorily defined functions the department must do, which we would have to either, I felt, have other divisions do or else be supported by other divisions that right now Habitat and Subsistence do. An example would be the Forest Practices Act stream buffers. The Habitat division saw about a 20% cut. It left us with a choice of figuring out how to fulfill our statutory mandate of protecting fish streams. An example would be on Prince of Wales Island, where you have heavy sport fishing. It's become a very popular sport fishing area. Should sport fish biologists go out and try and follow the statute, our statutory responsibilities, and protect those buffers, or should sport fish fund a biologist in Habitat to help do that? In some cases, we did have sport fish, com fish, or wildlife conservation that saw increasing funds fund some projects in Habitat and Subsistence to do these critical statutorily required responsibilities. We also saw reductions. Habitat division is reduced this year from the cuts last year. We will not be doing planning for game refuges. We'll see a reduction in the overhead and the support in the Habitat division. Subsistence division, the Southeast office is now an area office. We deleted one researcher from Southeast, one researcher from Fairbanks in the Subsistence division. We made 7 positions seasonal and shifted them over into the special projects budget, trying to see if someone else wanted their services, like the federal government might need expertise in subsistence, and they might fund some of those positions. The commissioner's office, we deleted one position from last year, and that will not be in this budget, and we've tried to cover that work as best we can with the remaining people in the commissioner's office, although we do see reduced ability to have a presence at the North Pacific Council and some of the other international arenas that we need to deal in. I do get a fair number of complaints from my compatriots on the North Pacific Council that they're not seeing enough of us there. I'm trying to make sure that we do cover that arena adequately, though. If you look at our budget this year, it's basically a status quo from last year. We feel that our general funds will kind of cover our core, our critical core budget. I think we'll do a good job of managing our commercial fisheries. We'll have a good sport fish and wildlife conservation program. I believe we'll continue to have sort of the best management program in the country. There will be things we won't do. Our data in the subsistence arena is getting old. They're probably areas we should be gathering new information. There's some developing fisheries that I'd like to see grow faster. I think we're doing some creative things in that arena, but we've just got to admit that there are things that we are just not doing. The governor did, as we did with all departments, fund the salary adjustments that the contracts put in place, which will show an increase in our budget. In the Comfish division, we're going to cut $200,000 of general funds and ask for a program receipt authority to allow some of the users to pay for limnology services for hatchery work. We believe that's an area where we can show that kind of efficiency. In the Comfish area, I've also asked the director to reprogram about $200,000 to get a better groundfish management program. I think that we can manage some of our nearshore groundfish fisheries for the benefit of Alaskans, particularly fishermen who need to diversify. They can't compete against these big catcher processors, but when salmon prices are dropping, for instance, people are looking for more fisheries to get into to cover their financial needs, and we think we can manage some of those ground fisheries in South Central and Southwest Alaska better than the federal government does. So we're going to move into that arena without jeopardizing our basic Comfish, salmon, herring management program. So that'll be a change that we'll be talking about in the subcommittee. One of the other changes you'll see is moving the capital improvement project, protecting states' rights, into the operating budget. I believe you talked to OMB about that. A number of those capital budget items are moving into the operating budget that look more, they really are more like operating projects. This is one, it's an ongoing project where we are defending ourselves in the Magnuson Act reauthorization, Endangered Species Act reauthorization, as well as implementation. Some of the ANILCA work where we're trying to protect the state's interests as various park units, refuges are develop their management plans, that kind of thing. Wildlife conservation will be asking for an increment to cover a broad spectrum of management programs across the state, mostly small increments to specific projects around the state. That's in a total of about $1 million in fish and game fund increment, and they'll be presenting the details of that to you in the subcommittee. There'll be a number of structural changes we'll be suggesting to our budget review units, request units, to make our divisions more efficient. Again, that's the kind of detail we'll be going over with you in the subcommittee. Finally, I know there's been some question about the Exxon Valdez funding. I just wanted to touch on that briefly. I'm certainly willing to talk about the questions that have come out about how the timing and process of that whole Exxon Valdez effort can mesh with the legislative timing and process. We've been working primarily with legislative budget and the LB&A committee during the interim, since that's the timing of the Exxon Valdez trustee council approval of projects. But certainly we'll, if there's a question there, we'll work with you to see how best to fit that into the legislature's process. So that's my general overview. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
There is one, yes.
I go fast enough, I tried to keep going. I
think it was your department. Will you cut from Exxon Valdez money this year? How much was your annual share that you get from Exxon Valdez oil spill money?
It's been going down. I think this year is about $10 million in projects in the department, and I think the year before was a little more, 10, 12 or 11. Kevin might know the specifics.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Martin, that's correct. And if I'm anticipating your question correctly, I think in the OMB's executive budget book, there showed a $10 million reduction. And that's, again, what Commissioner Rue was getting at with the way the budget process works. We report on actual, so you're seeing prior year numbers included where they were not included in the current year.
But that's what got me, Mr. Chairman, why it showed up as a cut, because I didn't realize any Exxon Valdez numbers were showing up in the four major departments receiving those dollars. At first, I thought they had cut your monies, and I don't mind at all that's happening. Your fees you're gaining on fishing license and stuff like that, I think for 10, 15 bucks we get a good bargain. Indication raised the fees. But they said no, it was Exxon Valdez money. Then I thought, well, how can you add that to the budget as a cut when it really didn't show up in the first place?
than Representative Martin. We're certainly not characterizing that as a reduction. It's merely that for 97, we don't know what the work plan is going to be. Those projects are submitted later in the spring. They go through a peer review over the summer. The trustees act on them in August, September. And so really until that time, we don't know.
Right.
And so they're not reflected in that 97 request.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I might. For example, lots of people put in proposals to the trustee council. We might have ideas for $15 million worth of projects. We may only get 10 or 8 or 7 in that competitive process.
Well, it's one of the proposals, I think, that's coming up with the Senate mostly, that Exxon Valdez oil money should show up in the budget, even though we know it's only a 9-year thing. Because suddenly, as some of the commissions are building up personnel and money, you talk about a crash. In 6 years, it's going to be a heck of a crash if general funds or some other money aren't put aside for that.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, one of the tests that the trustee council tries to put on each of those projects is that it doesn't represent normal agency management. In other words, it's something you wouldn't do had it not been for the spill. So now, why, you know, and so those are projects that without Exxon money, we wouldn't be doing them.
And I agree with you there, because in one department, there's 255 new employees. But then all of a sudden that money's out, and we're carrying those as state employees. What are we left with? You're in the commission, aren't you, sir, the trustee? Your department is one of the trustees.
Chairman, that's correct.
Could I put in your mind, so another concern we had is that we're buying more and more land. And somehow ever, I don't want the state to be stuck with, after the money's over with the management of those lands from general funds, which is decreasing. Is it possible that the Exxon Valdez trustee group could set alumside money to continue your agency, to continue management of those lands? But I think we need a corpus put together that would last more than, you know, the end of the funding for the six more years I think we have.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marty, that's an interesting idea. There is a restoration reserve that's building up that's to be available primarily for research that may or may not go on. I mean, a lot of these damages may go on a long time into the future, and there may be research that's warranted a long time into the future. So the trustee council has set up a restoration reserve that would be available after Exxon has finished its payments. It hasn't set aside a corpus for management of land. That's something that that's an interesting idea.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your goals for the Division of Wildlife, there was a section here talking about to establish a social science program for the division that complements our biological expertise. What does social science have to do with biology?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, that program is intended to help us understand the needs of the users of fish and wildlife. As I said early in my talk, we really manage for people. What we would do with that program is try and understand the various public's needs and attitudes and desires for fish and wildlife, and or wildlife in this case, and that would help us direct our management programs.
There was a recent article, if I may continue, there was a recent article by someone whose opinion I respect, and I'm sure you do too, Senator Sharp. And it was talking about the division has spent more than $160 million since 1980. $158 million for studies and $2 million on implementing these studies. Is that an accurate ratio there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, I'm not sure what he's speaking about in terms of studies. A lot of our job in wildlife management is to survey, count populations to know how many are out there, to survey hunters to know how successful they've been in taking resources so that we get a sense of how the health of the stocks out there, so that we know what the harvestable surplus is. So we spend a fair amount of time gauging that, and if you want to call that studying, but to me that's a key part of management, is inventorying and assessing the health of stocks so that we can advise the board what kind of seasons, what kind of bag limits that population can sustain so that we don't over-harvest or we don't under-harvest if there is a surplus there. I'm not sure what he includes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure what he includes under the rubric of study.
Okay. I think mostly what he's referring to is active management of the game, and I know that you mentioned harvestable surplus. And in some states, they harvest up to 50% of the harvestable surplus. And that might be deer population. I know there may be some differences there. But it seems from your own statistics that we're harvesting about 3%. Are you going to engage this year in more active management? Can we actually expect to see intensive management on your part from the policy that we set last year, actually 2 years ago, regarding game, to manage the game for the people, as you had said before, so that we can begin to manage from an abundance? I guess my question, without grandstanding too much here on the point, because I feel very strongly about the point that I don't think you are implementing intensive game management the way the legislature thought. But can we expect intensive game management? Can we see some predator control without gathering public consent and public will and all those things that the legislature is supposed to do on your part?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, you will see intensive management in its full definition that the legislature set, which includes everything from habitat manipulation on up. The governor and I have set a policy, which is that we will not implement predator control, wolf control programs by the state until we feel that there's good science and it's a cost-effective program and there's broad public acceptance, not necessarily support, but at least acceptance that this is a smart thing to do. We have initiated a study by the National Academy of Sciences to look at the scientific and economic foundation for predator control. The Board of Game has authorized a number of programs, a number of which don't kick in for a year and a half. The Game Board felt that we should have this study finished before the deadline kicked in. But there are several authorized. But no, you will not see the state of Alaska killing wolves until that Academy of Sciences study is done.
My last question or comment would be, I guess that's what, I don't mean to put words in Senator Sharp's mouth, but I guess that's probably what he's talking about, is if we have $160 million worth of studies since 1980, and then we have populations of ungulates diving all over the state radically, and then we come back saying that we now need to study it some more, with now a new agency or a new body, which is the National Academy of Science. I think that's what he was saying in the article here, was that, in fact, we've studied enough, and it's time to start managing the wolves instead of the people. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, we do have healthy ungulate populations throughout the state. There are some areas where the numbers are lower than we would like. Some of those may be caused by predators. Some may be habitat problems. Some may be weather problems. So we will be working on that issue, and I'm not sure we'll get a resolution that we'll all agree on, but we'll certainly work on it.
Thank you.
Representative Foster?
Yeah, you know, prior to the late 70s, your department had a few of probably no aircraft of their own. And it's kind of intrigued me. I know you've created kind of a small Air Force since then, and it's of concern to me because I think that there are considerably cheaper ways of doing business. And I just wanted you to know that I was going to take a real active interest in the subcommittee hearings regarding aircraft.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I might comment on that. Aircraft is something that we do have a number of pilots in the department, our biologists, and a number of them fly, but we also spend in excess of $2.5 million a year in charter aircraft as well. And typically, I think what we're trying to do is cover areas with our own pilots where we can't get commercial aircraft to fly us around doing our surveys and that kind of thing. So we try to have a mix between commercial as well as some of the aircraft that we fly ourselves.
Okay, any other questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Tomorrow we have the SB 84, which is a deposit and current fund bill, will be up in the afternoon, and also House Bill 241, which is prohibiting the personal use of campaign. And with that, the meeting's adjourned for today.
Goodbye.